Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. We are up to Book 11, Chapter 3. When Ermolov, having been sent by Kutuzov to inspect the position, told the field marshal that it was impossible to fight there before Moscow and that they must retreat, Kutuzov looked at him in silence. "Give me your hand," said he, and turning it over so as to feel the pulse, added, "You are not well, my dear fellow. Think what you are saying." Kutuzov could not yet admit the possibility of retreating beyond Moscow without a battle. On the Pokloni Hill, 4 miles from the Dogmolyov Gate of Moscow, Kutuzov got out of his carriage and sat down on a bench by the roadside. A great crowd of generals gathered around him, and Count Rostopchin, who had come out from Moscow, joined them. This brilliant company separated into several groups, who all discussed the advantages and disadvantages of the position, the state of the army, the plans suggested, the situation of Moscow, and the military questions generally. Though they had not been summoned for the purpose, and though it was not so called, they all felt that this was really a council of war. The conversations all dealt with public questions. If anyone gave or asked for personal news, it was done in a whisper, and they immediately reverted to general matters. No jokes or laughter or smiles, even, were seen among all these men. They evidently all made an effort to hold themselves at the height the situation demanded. And all these groups, while talking among themselves, tried to keep near the commander-in-chief, whose bench formed the centre of the gathering, and to speak so that he might overhear them. The commander-in-chief listened to what was being said and sometimes asked them to repeat their remarks, but did not himself take part in the conversations or express any opinion. After hearing what was being said by one or other of these groups, he generally turned away with an air of disappointment, as though they were not speaking of anything he wished to hear. Some discussed the position that had been chosen, criticizing not the position itself so much as the mental capacity of those who had chosen it. Others argued that a mistake had been made earlier, and that a battle should have been fought 2 days before. Others again spoke of the Battle of Salamanca, which was described by Crosart, a newly arrived Frenchman in a Spanish uniform. This Frenchman and one of the German princes serving with the Russian army were discussing the siege of Saragossa and considering the possibility of defending Moscow in a similar manner. Count Rostopchin was telling a fourth group that he was prepared to die with the city train bands under the walls of the capital, but that he still could not help regretting having been left in ignorance of what was happening, and that had he known it sooner, things would have been different. A fifth group, displaying the profundity of their strategic perceptions, discussed the direction the troops would now have to take. A sixth group was talking about absolute nonsense. Kutuzov's expression grew more and more preoccupied and gloomy. From all this talk he saw only one thing, that to defend Moscow was a physical impossibility in the full meaning of those words, that is to say, so utterly impossible that if any senseless commander were to give orders to fight, confusion would result from, but the battle would still not take place. It would not take place because the commanders not merely all recognized the position to be impossible, but in their conversations were only discussing what would happen after its inevitable abandonment. How could the commanders lead their troops to a field of battle they considered it impossible to hold? The lower grade officers and even the soldiers who also considered the position impossible, and therefore could not go to fight, fully convinced as they were of defeat. If Bennigsen insisted on the position being defended and others still discussed it, The question was no longer important in itself, but only a pretext for disputes and intrigue. The Kutuzov knew well. Bennigsen, who had chosen the position, warmly displayed his Russian patriotism. Kutuzov could not listen to this without wincing, by insisting that Moscow must be defended. His aim was as clear as daylight to Kutuzov. If the defense failed, to throw the blame on Kutuzov, who had brought the army as far as the Sparrow Hills without giving battle, if it succeeded, to claim the success as his own, or if battle were not given, to clear himself of the crime of abandoning Moscow. But this intrigue did not now occupy the old man's mind. One terrible question absorbed him, and to that question he heard no reply from anyone. The question for him now was, have I really allowed Napoleon to reach Moscow, and when did I do so? When was it decided? Can it have been yesterday when I ordered Platov to retreat, or was it the evening before when I had a nap and told Bennigsen to issue orders? Or was it earlier still? When was this terrible affair decided? Moscow must be abandoned. The army must retreat, and the orders to do so must be given. To give that terrible order seemed to him equivalent to resigning the command of the army. And not only did he love power, to which he was accustomed, the honours awarded to Prince Prozorsky, under whom he had served in Turkey, galled him, but he was convinced that he was destined to save Russia, and that was why, against the Emperor's wish, and by the will of the people, he had been chosen commander-in-chief. He was convinced that he alone could maintain command of the army in these difficult circumstances, and that in all the world he alone could encounter the invincible Napoleon without fear, and he was horrified at the thought of the order he had to issue. But something had to be decided, and these conversations around him, which were assuming too free a character, must be stopped. He called the most important generals to him. My head, be it good or bad, must depend on itself, said he, rising from the bench, and he rode to Filí, where his carriages were waiting. All right, there we go. Another chapter down, and here we have Kutuzov scratching his head and trying to figure out when exactly had he given Moscow to Napoleon. He also worries about his own position as the commander of the army, and he wonders that how is this going to reflect on him? Is he going to lose his post as the commander of the army? It seems to me it was merely a question of morale, but I mean, understandably, the Russian army's morale was about as low as it can get. They've just had half of their men slaughtered. But in one of the previous chapters, where it sort of retrospectively looks back over what happened, it basically says if the French or the Russians at this time did one last push, they would have succeeded. So if at this time if it was possible to rally the troops to do one last push up against the French, that would have been the end of it. But it was not possible. The morale was so flat, and all the commanders were sure that they would lose, that it was just not able to happen. There was not much conversation about this particular chapter, and I don't really think it was the kind of chapter that stirs up a lot to say. I will say this, though. We have got 742 followers on Podbean now, this little old podcast. And we're averaging somewhere around 250 downloads per day. 250 on a lower day and 350 on a bigger day. So doesn't that just blow your mind? 250 odd people listening to my stupid voice reading War and Peace every day. Thank you to every single person out there listening. For me now, this is the last thing I usually do before I go to bed every night. It's 10 p.m. right now. as I record this, and I've got it down to a fine art. I can get, if an episode goes for, say, 20 minutes, I'll have that thing recorded, edited, and uploaded within half an hour. So if nothing else, by the end of this experience, I'm going to be a very good podcast recorder and editor. So that's kind of fun. But yeah, it's typically the last thing I do at night. You know, I do the podcast and then I'll maybe watch an episode of a TV show or read a book or something like that until I fall asleep. But it's how I end my day. And it's kind of grown to me, for me to be something I really enjoy. It's a really good way to end the day. Of course, there's the odd day where I leave it a little bit too late. Like, for example, about half an hour ago, as I sit here right now, I was 97% asleep on the couch, and I could have quite easily have just fallen asleep and called it a night, but I dragged my ass off the couch and came and sat in front of the microphone. And that happens quite often, actually. But I still really enjoy it. It's still a really great way to end the night. So thanks again for listening, because that has made it possible for me to have this hobby. Also, thanks to the people who support it with the Patreon page, which is really cool. I'm still getting enough Patreon support to cover the hosting fees for uploading this podcast. So that's kind of cool that it's not actually, you know, I'm not out of pocket. That's a good thing. All right, enough. Thank you for listening today. I will see you tomorrow.